Hello, adventurers. I am recording this on Monday, May 4th, 2020. I am in Pasadena still, and still under, I guess we are calling it sheltering at home for the COVID-19 pandemic. This is not actually going to be a brand new episode. I am reposting episode 8, which was my first ever interview for the show. It came to my attention that some of the older episodes had dropped off the podcast feed, which I assume happened because of storage issues. So I have deleted a lot of the episodes where I recorded the audio version of my memoir. So I kept a few of those episodes up just to give you like a flavor of what the memoir is. But since you can buy the memoir on, try saying the word memoir 3 times fast. It just doesn't, my mouth is just like so contorted. So the memoir is available as Kindle or as a paperback on Amazon. So you can always hop over there, and it's the name of the show, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, and get my full story there. But I did want to share Alexia Johnstone's story with you again, because she was just such an eloquent guest. And when I saw that her interview had dropped off the feed, I was like, well, we have to remedy that. And today is, as I'm recording this, is the first day of Maternal Mental Health Week. So it just seemed like a really good time to get a new episode posted, especially, you know, for anyone at any point listening to this, postpartum depression and, you know, all maternal mood disorders. It's just so incredibly lonely and isolating, and these stories can really connect us and give us hope and inspiration. But right now, as I'm recording this in early May 2020, my heart just really breaks for all the moms out there with newborns who are dealing with all the difficulty and upheaval of, you know, taking care of a new baby, whether it's your first or your 10th or anywhere in between. But to be doing that during a pandemic, life is always uncertain, but goodness me, right now, I swear a lot. So let me just warn you right now. I swear a lot. I just try not to swear in the first couple minutes of the intro. But so anyway, goodness me, that's the understatement of the year. We are just living with all sorts of uncertainty. And it's just tricky. So I thought, like, let's get more of those stories back up. So I hope you enjoy it, and I'm just tacking on everything, which includes the old kind of lame intro that I used to do for the show. So if you want to hit skip like the next 30, 45 seconds, go right ahead. I'm not offended. I love you, and I'm just thinking of all of you during this experience. I mean, you're always in my heart, at, you know, whether or not there's a pandemic, but really this is dedicating this right now to all the moms with babies living during the COVID-19 crisis.
Hi everyone, it's Courtney. I'm a regular mom who had postpartum depression in 2013 after the birth of my daughter Pippa. And this is my weekly podcast, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, that talks about maternal mental illnesses like postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety and OCD, postpartum PTSD, postpartum psychosis, bipolar peripartum onset, and pregnancy depression and anxiety. This show is committed to spreading awareness about maternal mood disorders. It is not a substitute for professional treatment. You can learn more about this show at ppdadventures.com. There's also a Facebook page at facebook.com/ppdadventures. Or you can follow me on Instagram at courtney.novak. And of course, you can always subscribe for updates. The music you're listening to is called Cute from Ben Sound, and it's available at bensound.com. And now, on to the show. Hey, hey, look at me recording a fancy introduction for the show. Are you impressed? Is it too long? It's too long. I know. It's way too long. But, you know, it took me an hour to make that on Sunday. So we're just going to go with it for a few episodes and then I'll fix it up. It's, you know, it took me a while to figure out. I'm using this free software called Audacity, and I had to do a bunch of tutorials, and I got that intro together and I was so proud of it. And then I realized, shit, it's like a minute long, which is way too long for an intro. So, and now you get to listen to me ramble about it. So I promise I'll get it fixed eventually, but again, steep learning curve, bear with me. But today we have our first interview with Alexia Johnstone, who is a mental health counselor in Massachusetts, about 20 minutes outside of Worcester, which is, I probably just mispronounced that. It's one of those spellings. It's W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R. And I'm actually, my paternal grandparents are from Worcester, Massachusetts. And I spent a week in college doing research at like the antiquarian library for my history thesis on the publication of Ben Franklin's autobiography. And I am so happy. It's, you know, we're 8 episodes in and I have finally mentioned my love for Benjamin Franklin. He's been eclipsed recently by my passion for increasing awareness about postpartum depression. But I think if Ben Franklin was alive today, he would definitely have a podcast, and he would definitely approve of me taking this method for, you know, spreading the word. And so, yeah, anyway, small world. You know, have blood relatives, tons of them still living out there in Worcester, Massachusetts, and that's where my first interviewee works and lives. And got treated for postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, and pregnancy depression. Actually, she didn't get treated for the pregnancy depression. You'll hear that in her story. That was part of the problem. And also postpartum OCD. Alexia was just so gracious in telling us her story. I feel so lucky to have had her on the show. And I think you will really, really enjoy her story today. Some possible triggers for moms listening. Her daughter was in the NICU, was born a little early, not too early, but still early. And her daughter stopped breathing in her arms at one point while she was in the NICU. So that could be a trigger for some of you moms listening today. And she had some intrusive thoughts of flinging her baby, or just her baby being flung. And then when her second child was born, she had intrusive thoughts about her children being sexually abused. So I don't want to spoil the episode for you, but I do want to highlight some possible issues for anyone listening out there. So, okay, that's enough of me talking. You've been listening to me for 7 episodes. I think we're ready for someone else. So without further ado, I give you Alexia. Hi, Alexia. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand you had postpartum depression, and did you also have perinatal depression?
I had perinatal depression, and I also had really significant postpartum anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And some OCD.
So what happened with the perinatal depression? That's pregnancy depression for people who...
Yeah, depression while you're pregnant. What happened with me was I have a 15-year at this point history of anxiety and depression. I've been on and off of meds and in and out of therapy since I was a teen. When I decided to get pregnant with my first child, it was at the end of a really big time of change for me. I had just graduated from graduate school. I had been dating my now husband for 5 years, but we got married and decided we wanted to have children. And got pregnant on our honeymoon, which people wish for, but actually happened to me. So I had just started a brand new job, and my job was working at a school for kids with really significant behavior problems, which is something I actually really enjoy, but is also something that's very, very stressful. These are kids who are assaultive, kids who yell and scream at you, kids who literally can't go to school anywhere else. It's a therapeutic environment because I'm a mental health counselor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So in the midst of all this, I get pregnant. I get really, really sick in the beginning with morning sickness. I work at a school, which means I have to be at work at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like nauseous and going to work and, you know, starting this brand new job in this brand new field. And in the midst of all this, my husband gets fired from his job. And at this time I wasn't in counseling. I wasn't on any meds. I'd actually been doing pretty well for a while, which is kind of my history. Like my anxiety and my depression goes through periods where it goes away and then it kind of comes back. And, so there I am. I'm pregnant at this point, like 4 months pregnant. My husband, who had been carrying the benefits and who had made an income greater than mine, was fired from his job. during a leadership change at his company, and I have to keep working because I am now the only person holding a full-time job and holding the health insurance for my new baby. So my husband takes this really, really hard and starts to withdraw into himself and really pull back from me because he feels like he's failed. He feels like I'm supposed to be the provider and I got fired and I just got married and I have this baby coming. And so at this point, I start getting really, really, really stressed out. And I told my OBGYN, who wasn't someone I had a relationship with prior to being pregnant, about my history, and she like wrote it all down, and that was kind of it. She never asked me anything about like, how are you feeling? Are you on meds? Nothing. So my husband withdraws. Money's super tight because I have an entry-level job at a nonprofit organization, so I am not making a lot of money. And I am covering a medical family plan, which I live in Massachusetts, so that's like $600 a month for health insurance.
Oh, that's enough.
Yeah, out of my pretty paltry paycheck, which I was only making like $38,000 a year.
Oh my gosh.
So I was incredibly stressed about money and about my husband because he had been applying for jobs and not getting anything, because this was in 2010 when he lost his job. I had my baby in 2011, and the economy was not fantastic at this point.
No.
At all. It was worse than it is now.
It was really good timing for you.
It was great timing. So I start getting super, super, super stressed. And what happens to me is when I get really stressed, I can go one of two ways. I get super anxious and I start having panic attacks, or I get really depressed. I got depressed. Mm-hmm. And I started feeling like my extremities, like my arms and legs would go numb. I would like not be able to sleep at night. But I have to get up in the morning and go to work because we needed the money. And I would come home and I would try to talk about it. And my husband, who was basically in his own depression at this point, was like, why are you complaining? We're supposed to be happy. You got pregnant so fast. The baby's healthy, blah, blah, blah. All of these things are true. But I was still getting more and more depressed. And I just had no... And keep in mind, I'm a mental health counselor, right? Mm-hmm. I have no idea that this is a thing, like getting pregnant while you're, like being depressed while you're pregnant, or that it required any kind of special treatment. So I went back to my therapist that I had been seeing on and off for several years. She knew me really well. And she's like, oh, like you're a type A perfectionist type. You're in a lot of change. Like, of course you're stressed out, which again is true. But because that is me, like I'm totally an anxious achiever type. But I'm like, okay, she's telling me this is normal. She's telling me that, you know, moms who are high achievers normally get nervous during pregnancy because they want everything to go well. And she never asked the right questions, which I only know now. So, for example, one of the things that happened to me when I was pregnant that I didn't realize or recognize was I was obsessed with the idea that my daughter had a spine malformation in my womb. There was no ultrasound that said this. There was no family history, nothing. But I was obsessed. Like, and I would check how much folic acid I was eating all day because I was like, I know it. Like, she's going to be born and she's going to have this spinal abnormality. I know now that I was having like OCD symptoms and having intrusive thoughts, but at the time I didn't really understand that that wasn't typical. I don't want to use the word normal because normal is a big range, but being obsessed with something that you have literally no reason to believe is not typical.
Right. That's a good word. I'm always using normal and then I hate it, but yeah, typical.
Yeah, it's not typical. Like, for example, if I had got a bunch of tests back that said she might have X, Y, and Z, it would be understandable to worry about it.
Right.
That did not happen.
So you just somehow got it in your head, and it became your obsession.
Yes. I was, like, obsessed. So what I would do, because my husband didn't want to listen to me cry, my parents were over the moon about being grandparents and mm-hmm. still are. And I didn't want to tell them what a hard time I was having, both with my husband and with being pregnant, because I was embarrassed. Because I was newly married. Mm-hmm. I got pregnant right away. I have so many friends who have struggled with like infertility and miscarriages. One of those things, my pain's not valid.
Yeah.
So I didn't tell them, which is really unfortunate because they're actually like pretty supportive. Mm-hmm. So I had them coming at me like thrilled with their first grandchild, and they're like amazing grandparents. So like that has played out. And my husband, who would, like, come home, I'd come home from work, and he'd be, like, sitting on the couch doing nothing. And then I'd just cry in the car and then go inside so that no one would have to listen to me.
What was it like for you when you felt depressed? Because I wasn't, like, when I went into my experience with postpartum depression, I really had no idea what depression was other than the crying. But I didn't cry. Like, what did it feel like for you?
For me, it was a familiar feeling because I had been depressed several times before. But what was different about this time was that I did a lot of reading, like a lot of new moms. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to shield. I had this deep belief that my child would be totally messed up if she knew I was depressed. But the actual physical symptoms for me are sleeplessness, body aches, a lot of minor viruses. Like I got like every cold and like every sickness. My arms and legs would go numb, which is something that I think is also part of my anxiety. Mm-hmm. I would just got really exhausted, but not exhausted like sleepy exhausted, exhausted like everything felt like this huge effort. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those people who eats their depression, so I was hungry all the time but never full.
Oh yes. Hand raised. I ate constantly.
All the time. I gained like 80 pounds with my daughter. And I'm not very big. I'm 5'2". So it was a significant weight gain. And I was never, like, I was never full. Nothing ever tasted good. Part of that was the pregnancy. But part of that is characteristic of my depression as well. Mm-hmm. And I used this image in my head where I would picture her inside my... because I'm an expressive arts therapist, so it did help me in this way. I'm an expressive arts therapist, so I use a lot of imagery and mindfulness in my practice, mm-hmm. Which means, like, I think I focus on the present. I use, like, soothing pictures and ideas in my head and actually visualize them to make myself feel better. I would picture her inside the amniotic sac as this, like, protective force field. And I think one of the reasons my depression went out to my arms and legs is because I would picture myself, like, pushing it away from her.
And into your extremities.
My extremities. Like, away from the womb, into my extremities.
Oh, gosh. The body is so complicated.
It really is.
And body-mind, like, mind connection.
Yeah, like, the mind-body connection is really intense. So fast forward, I stopped going to therapy because I tried to bring my husband so my therapist could yell at him, and that didn't go well. And I stopped going to therapy. I wasn't taking any meds. Nobody said anything about meds. Everything I read on the internet was the propaganda saying that, like, we don't know what could happen, blah, blah, blah. So 35 weeks along, I go into labor and I have my daughter at 35 weeks, 5 days. And she is escorted promptly to the NICU. She's 4 pounds, 7 ounces. Nothing is actually wrong with her.
Just she's early.
But she's early. So no spine malformation. Just early. So I go from being depressed and working full time at this place where teenagers yell at me all day to sitting in the NICU for 14 hours a day. I didn't have a baby shower.
Oh.
Because my mom planned it for 36 weeks, which I told her not to do, but she did, because moms. And my baby's in the hospital. She's hooked up to all these monitors. And I stopped being able to eat. Like, I was so nervous about her.
Mm-hmm.
And even though nothing was actually developmentally wrong with her, because she was early, two things happened. She had to get antibiotics right away because I never got the strep B test, because they do that at 36 weeks.
Right.
so they didn't know if I was a carrier or not. And the second thing that happened was she would do this thing where she would Brady, which means she would fall into a deep sleep and stop breathing.
Oh.
Yeah, it was really convenient. And she would also not be able to suck, swallow, and breathe, which is just, a brain development piece that happened in the last, month of pregnancy that she didn't get because she was already out. So I'm sitting there in the NICU by myself watching the monitors. My husband at this point had gotten a new job. He was underemployed, but he was working. And since he had just gotten this job, he went to work. He dropped me off at the hospital, went to work all day long. People would come visit on and off, which was fine. But when you're in the NICU, there's no place for people to sit. And the hospital that I delivered at, which is UMass Memorial in Worcester, Massachusetts, has a really actually advanced neonatal unit compared to other hospitals. But there still wasn't this warm, friendly place in a typical delivery room where you can sit. There's no couch, because your baby's not with you. Your baby's hooked up to this everything. So you're holding this tiny baby, and they want you to hold them as much as possible, and they're dangling from all these wires. And I couldn't sleep. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't eat. I had PTSD, and I found out later that I had post-traumatic stress because she stopped breathing in my arms. I was feeding her, and she choked.
Oh.
And she just started turning blue.
Oh, no.
Which is, again, pretty typical for babies in the NICU.
Right.
But did not improve upon my already, really bad mood.
Well, we don't prepare ourselves for the NICU because we all assume that's not going to happen to me.
Right. You assume. And even if you don't assume, nobody tells you this could happen.
Yeah, that wasn't in any of my pregnancy books.
No, it's not. So anyway, she's actually gaining weight and doing fine, getting amazing care. And one of the things, too, that really came up for me in, reflecting on my story is one of the reasons that I never looked up how I felt was because my baby was, stopping breathing. I looked up everything to do with her and how to take care of her and what could go wrong with her and what I needed to look up for her. Because I wasn't important at that moment. So we were in the NICU for 10 days, which is not very long, because she did, once she hit 37 weeks, gestational age, she started to act like a newborn baby.
Oh, good.
Which was very good. The earlier babies are, the longer it takes them to kind of get up to speed.
Right.
And she was born, because if she had stayed in the womb 10 days, she would have been 37 weeks, which is still early, but they wouldn't have put her in the NICU.
Right.
So, anyway, I get home with her. I have no memory of bringing her home to this day. I have no memory. I don't remember it at all. And I can't sleep. I can't eat. And I am terrified to be alone with her. Terrified. So when my husband goes to work, I have my mom come over every single day because I can't be alone. I'm just so scared and I don't feel bonded to her at all. I'm just, how is this person stuck in my life forever? And it started in the hospital, actually. I started having these obsessive thoughts of her being flung against the wall and her skull cracking open and bleeding down the wall.
And would it be you flinging her or just the thought of her being flung?
Both.
Okay.
And I also started to have these intrusive thoughts about kicking my husband down the stairs. Because at this point, I was so mad at him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that people don't get mad at their spouses or their kids, because everybody does. But it would be this powerful urge. You'd be at the tops of stairs. We lived in a condo on the second floor. And I would, I'd have to, restrain myself from, kicking him backwards. So I'm a mess at this point and not hiding it very well. And instead of people helping me, people are mad at me.
Oh.
My husband's mad at me. My mom is mad at me. because at this point I started to get really, really anxious, like to the point where I was actually having panic attacks like multiple times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And getting ragey. So I would just yell and scream at everybody. And I was breastfeeding at this time. And I had, because breast is best and blah, blah, blah. And when you have a premature baby, they really emphasize pumping because breast milk is easier for preemies to digest than formula.
Okay.
And now, actually, at the hospital that I was at, they actually have a donor program so that preemies can have breast milk, whether it's from their mom or somebody else that you can be a part of, which I think is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have that when I had my daughter. So she was getting what I called milkshake formula because it had like a million calories. She was only 4 pounds, 7 ounces. And then I was pumping. And I'm a terrible pumper. I don't let down for machines. So I was like pumping every 2 hours, waking myself up in the middle of the night to pump. And doing the same thing when I got home because I had a low supply, which, of course, I couldn't eat. It's really hard to make breast milk when you can't eat or drink or sleep. So 3 weeks into this disaster, I was lying on my bed, and I had been awake for 24 hours. I couldn't sleep. And I called my husband at work, and I was like, something's really wrong. I was like, I have to go to the hospital. And he didn't believe me.
Oh. My husband didn't believe me either.
Really?
I was actually with my parents, and they took me to my obstetrician, and I was suicidal at that point, and no one really knew. And I told my doctor, and she said, I need you to admit yourself to the hospital. And I was too afraid to call my husband, and I made my mom do it. And when we were, I haven't ever told anyone this, but when we were in the actual, like, psych ward, and my husband was, like, and we're being processed, my husband said, like, the only crazy thing you've ever done is admit yourself here. And it was just, well, and the thing is, I was like, well, I've done such a good job acting that he had no idea what was going on in my head. But it was just like such a, oh my God, I really need this. And people, I was so feeling guilty and anxious at that point. And it was so, like, I felt so guilty about leaving my child. I felt like this is my job. I'm supposed to be able to take care of her 24/7.
Yeah.
And then to have people think, I really needed people to believe me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing you just reminded me, I forgot about this, that happened was my husband knew I was struggling. And what he wanted to do was take my daughter and go to his mom's house. So his sister, who was living there at the time, could help him and I could rest. This was his idea of a brilliant plan, was to leave me alone at home and take the baby and leave.
Oh, he was going to leave you?
Yep.
Oh.
I was going to be alone.
Oh, that's a good strategy.
That was his big plan. My dad actually interfered and called him. And my parents aren't like this. Like, they're pretty, like, respectful of boundaries. And this is your relationship and blah, blah, blah. And he actually called my husband. He's like, you can't take the baby and leave her. Like, you can't do this. And he freaked out, and he's like, your dad can't tell me what to do. And I was like, you can't leave me here.
There's just no roadmap for this.
No. And so I call him at work, and he works in retail, so it's tough for him to, like, leave work. And he's like, well, I can't leave work right now. I was like, I have to go to the emergency room. And I was really calm when I called him, because I'm actually fantastic in an emergency, even if it's my own emergency. Because, I mean, that's what I do. I do crisis care, like mental health crisis care, which is also how I knew something was really wrong with me at this point. And so he's like, call all your friends, because all my friends are therapists. So I called them, and I was like, so I listened to him. I was like, this is what I'm doing. And they're like, yeah, you need to go to the ER. So I called him again, and he's like, and at that point, one of my parents was with me. I think my dad. I actually don't remember. And so whichever parent wasn't there came over, and my mom stayed with my daughter. My dad went to CVS and bought, like, all the formula. And then he brought me, because I was like, this is what we need to do. So he went to CVS and bought all the formula, the same type she had had in the hospital. Because she never had a problem taking a bottle, which was good. Because in the NICU, they give them bottles because they get vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really get that from your breast. And so, and he took me to the emergency room. And I went to the emergency room. It wasn't packed. I actually got in really quick. And I lied when I got there. Ugh. Because I am a therapist. And I knew it would happen if I told them that I wanted to die. So I knew it would happen. And I couldn't do that. And I've never told anybody that before. That I lied. Because I lied. Blatantly. Overtly lied. And I told them, I was like, I'm a new mom. I have a history of depression. Like, just as calm as I'm telling you now, even though, like, I hadn't eaten in, like, 3 days. I hadn't really slept in 3 weeks. This was 3 weeks after I brought my daughter home.
Ugh.
But keep in mind, at this point, I had been depressed for more than 6 months.
Right.
So I'm like, this is the medicine I used to be on. I just need this medicine. And they were like, I was like, I'm having anxiety attacks. And they're like, well, we can't write a script. We don't do that in the ER. But they gave me a prescription for Klonopin, which is like a pretty heavy-duty tranquilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, you need to sleep. You have to sleep. You have to stop having panic attacks. You have to sleep. So they wrote me a short-term prescription for 10 pills, told me to take them 4 times a day. And to call my primary care on Monday and to get an SSRI since I had a history of knowing what worked. And then they gave me a phone number that I called and then didn't follow through on. The hospital I delivered at, UMass in Worcester, has a women's mental health outpatient clinic that I could have been going to this whole time, working with a perinatal psychiatrist. And they did, intakes for postpartum women as well. And I did call them and I scheduled an intake. And when the day came, the thought of like bringing my kid somewhere by myself at 9 o'clock in the morning was too much. And I just never went. I just did not go.
Right.
So I went to my PCP. I called her up. She knew me really well. I've had the same doctor forever. So she just looked at my history and wrote me a prescription. And then I rehooked up with my old therapist because I didn't realize I could go to somebody who actually did this. And then I went to the psychiatrist that worked in that practice who was actually really helpful. My therapist continued to not be that helpful.
Hmm.
But the panic attacks stopped. I took Lexapro. I stopped breastfeeding so that I could sleep and alternate with my husband. And even though my husband was not very supportive of me during this period, he was and is a super involved parent. So there was never any question that he would and could take care of the baby. But he was so angry at me. He was in denial. He couldn't believe I had done something like this. Because after I left the ER, I went to my parents' house, took the Klonopin, and went to sleep. And I slept for like 12 hours because I needed someone to take care of me.
Yeah.
And then I went home.
12 hours of sleep and you're supposed to be recovered.
Yeah, I went home and didn't want to be with my baby, didn't want to be with my husband. And I was really sick for a really long time. My husband was still underemployed, so I went back to work at 12 weeks. Because I needed the money.
I just wish we weren't doing this on Skype. I just want to be like right next to you and able to give you a hug.
No, it's okay. I've told this story a lot, but not for a long time. And never all together. So, anyway, we're at home and my daughter is totally fine. We had a visiting nurse because she was a preemie. And so that was great. I had that kind of reassurance for my anxious mind because this like super nice nurse came every week and weighed her and measured her and looked at her and told me that she was great and that I'd be okay. And I had a couple of really good friends who would just come over and bring me iced coffee and watch TV with me and hold the baby. And my mom would come over and she just didn't understand and still doesn't. And if I was in a bad mood, she'd get really mad at me. Like a couple times she stormed out, like, you don't appreciate me. Mm-hmm. And I know I was super rude to her. Like, I'm not pretending I wasn't.
Right.
But she just had like no concept. But my dad used to come over and just take me for these long drives and then bring me home, which is like what I needed. So I was really depressed for over a year. It took me a really long time to get better. Mm-hmm. And then when I started to feel better, and things with my husband were really, really tough. We ended up going to couples counseling to really work through a bunch of these things. It was helpful, but not as helpful as it needed to be. Mm-hmm. He was still going through like job transitions at this point because this transition ended up in being a complete career change, which now 5 years later has worked out. But at the time was incredibly stressful. And my mom was watching my daughter. Because that is how we could afford to work and be parents. Mm-hmm. And she was great, and she took amazing care of my daughter, but did not understand what I needed. And what really happened during that time was I felt like I was basically the worst person in the world, and I just let my mom and my husband take over. And I would pray when I picked my daughter up from my mom's that she would sleep until my husband got home from work. Because I'd pick her up around like 3:30, because mm-hmm. I worked in a school. And then my husband would get home around 5:30. And I would just hope that she'd take her afternoon nap and I wouldn't have to do anything.
Well, you were still working with the at-risk teens?
Yeah, I did that job for 4 years.
So, not a easy job.
No, not an easy job at all.
Not like an emotionally uplifting...
No.
So not recharging your batteries.
No, it was completely depleting. And but the thing about mental health and working as a mental health counselor that a lot of people don't understand is that a lot of the work is hourly. Mm-hmm. And in order to support my family, I had to have a job that had a salary and benefits. And a lot of people don't get that. And the only way to get one of those jobs as a new mental health counselor is to work in a hospital program, a residential program, or a school.
Oh.
Because those are the places where you're actually on staff. So, but people like who are listening to this, like if you go see a therapist, there is a 99% chance that that therapist is paid by the session. Even if you're going to some sort of big agency or hospital. So anyway, I'm going to work. I finally am getting better. Things with my husband are better. Things with my daughter are better. And when she was 18 months old, I started to feel more like myself. I had some energy. I actually liked her. And I got pregnant again because I was very devoted to the idea of siblings. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself at this point, I was like, okay, this BS that I've been through is ridiculous. Like, this did not have to happen. This did not have to be this way. Like, somebody should have said something. Somebody should have figured out something was wrong with me. And at this point, I had finally had some time to focus on myself and focus on my mental health and focus on getting better. And I had finally found some resources. Can you still hear me? My computer just, like, shut off.
Oh, yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. My computer went to sleep. So I finally started using the interwebs and I managed to pull together. I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to be unmedicated during this pregnancy, and I'm not going to have somebody, like, not, you know, taking care of me. And so this time around, I was 6 weeks pregnant. I got pregnant easily again. And I, at 6 weeks, I set up like 40,000 appointments with perinatal psychiatrist at UMass Medical, with an OBGYN who was recommended through my local childbirth center as somebody who worked with women with perinatal mood disorders. I found a specialized therapist. I paid $150 at a session, like a session out of pocket for. And I found a nutritionist because I never went down to my pre-pregnancy weight, which is not so much about vanity, but about the fact that I'm a small person. Mm-hmm. I knew that if I gained another 80 pounds and didn't lose 25 of them again, that I still haven't lost, which again is fine. That would put me like in a health spot where I would be like pretty overweight for how tall I am. And I was like, I'm not going to have a miserable pregnancy. Like, this is not going to happen. And I became so I was with my, like, awesome new therapist. My pregnancy was a lot more comfortable this time in the beginning because I figured out what was making me nauseous. I was still working at the therapeutic day school for children with severe emotional and behavioral difficulties. At this point, I was in a leadership role there, so I had a little less day-to-day physical contact with the kids, which was helpful. And then I was thinking about it, and I told my husband, I was like, when I go out for maternity leave, I'm leaving my job. Because at this point, he had a steady job at the place he's still working. He was taking care of our benefits. And I said, I'm tapped out. I can't do this anymore, and I'm not going to. I'm going to figure out something else. And he said, okay. And that was a huge relief, because I was like, I can't do this a second time. It's too much. So I took really good care of myself through my pregnancy, and despite everything, started having contractions at 32 weeks, went into the hospital, was admitted. My contractions stopped, but I was monitored for 5 hours and given fluids. I was petrified I was going to have another preemie. And my doctor and my therapist were both very aware of how I felt, and it felt really great to be validated. And they were like, when you're on the wrong side of statistics once, you know it can happen again. Especially because with my other daughter, like, there was no cause for her prematurity that was medically detected. I didn't have high blood pressure. I didn't have diabetes. I didn't have, you know, anything. And I went to the doctor 3 days before she was born, and I wasn't even dilated. So I wasn't dilated at 32 weeks. The contractions went away. I got hydrated. It was a super hot summer. I had both my kids in the summer. I went home. My husband, again, had a big struggle with acknowledging, and my mom, that anything was actually wrong. Mm-hmm. My husband was a little more open. My mom was just like, but what really is wrong? And I'm like, I went into early labor and it stopped. And she's like, no, but what was wrong? And I was like, do you want to read my discharge paper from the hospital? Because that's what it says. You know, like, just this mentality of, you need to tell me that you're going to be okay. Which is not helpful. So anyway, my pregnancy went along. The end of my pregnancy with my second kid was super uncomfortable. I carried her really, really low. Mm-hmm. And I had an ice pack shoved in my underwear like 24/7. And it was super hot, and it was August. But I took it really easy. I left my school job. I now know that this is illegal, but I went to my job and I was like, I want to go out and start my maternity leave early. And they're like, well, if you do that, we can't give you any disability. Because the way that maternity leave worked at my company was you would get 2 weeks of disability pay for a vaginal birth. 4 weeks for a C-section, and then you would get paid out any sick or vacation you had accrued. So for me, that was about 6 weeks of my salary. So they relocated me to another program where I had a desk job until at 37 weeks, exactly, I went into labor with my second kid and had her. And she did not have to go to the NICU, but she was really, really small because I just have really small babies. Like, I have people who have in my life who have delivered at 32 weeks whose kids were bigger than mine. She was 5 pounds, 4 ounces. But because she was so early, they had to do all these tests on her before I could take her home. And they then I had to go to the pediatrician, like, every day of my life with her to get her bilirubin levels tested, because my kids also come out, like, yellow.
So do mine.
Nice. And they – but they – neither of them had I can't even think of it right now.
Jaundice?
Yes. Neither of them had jaundice. They have – I have, like, olive-toned skin, and when you're born early without that, like, rosy newborn glow, your skin is just, like, yellow if you are going to grow up and have olive-toned skin. So, anyway – they were doing what they needed to do. I mean, their bilirubin levels were slightly elevated, but they never had jaundice. Neither of them did.
Hmm.
And so I had to bring her every day to get, like, poked and prodded and weighed. But I was okay. I was, like, really closely monitored by my therapist and my OB/GYN and my psychiatrist. And I was okay. The only thing that came back was I started having intrusive thoughts again. And this intrusive thought was that my children were being sexually abused. Now, keep in mind, I'm home with them 24/7. And no one else is really watching them without me around because I left my job and I'm home. But knowing what an intrusive thought is and having someone actually ask you about it...
Mm-hmm.
Makes it way different than sitting there with your brain, like, running fast forward and no one telling you, like, hey, you're thinking this thing that is not logical. Like, what are we going to do about it? So I was able to cope because I was able to actually have that conversation with myself, you know, like, straight up cognitive behavioral therapy, like thought replacement, where, you know, I'd have the thought and I'd say, do you have any logical reason to believe this? And I would say, no, my children have literally not left my sight for 48 hours. And then I'd be like, okay, we need to, like, put this thought aside. Which was really helpful. And the other piece that was really helpful was at this point, I have found a number of support groups online. But what was really interesting is that I never found, you know, we've connected through being warrior moms through Postpartum Progress, and I actually didn't find them until after I found a support group on Facebook that recommended them. So I had already given birth to my second child before I found Postpartum Progress.
Oh, I'll have to get the groups from you after the show so I can put them on my show notes.
Yeah.
For every group out there, need to find them.
Yes, I have all the groups.
Oh, wonderful.
It was having a baby after a PMDD. So I will send the links. And you can just ask to join them and they add you. And it was great to talk to other women who are just as terrified as I was of having a relapse.
Because there are resources out there. The more I dig into this, the more I learn. But there just hasn't been enough marketing for all of them. And sometimes it's just tough for people to find. Like, what's going to help them?
It is really hard. And so it was super hard. And I was the first, and I had so many things, like, working against me in terms of finding resources. I was the first person in my friend group to have a baby. I worked with a large amount of 20-something men. I just really didn't have any accidental supports in my life with my first child. And with my second, I found it all myself. I was like, I don't care if I have to drive to New York City to get the help I need. Like, this is not going to happen again. Like, it just can't. and I made like a really detailed postpartum plan, which was also really reassuring. Like I signed releases with all my doctors and with my husband for them, because at this point my husband was on board for me like not to get sick again.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, if you think I'm acting weird, like you need to call these people and like program the numbers into his phone.
I should have done that.
Yeah. I mean, he was still not 100% on board. And the only reason I'm saying this now is because it's 5 years later and our kids are 5 and 3. And now he's like, this is what I didn't understand and this is why I couldn't get through it. But it's taken us that long. So that's the other thing I want to share is that, like, I know I've read some of the unsupportive spouse things and some spouses become supportive and some don't. But either way, it takes a really long time if they don't get it right away. And I had a ton of residual anger.
Mm-hmm.
That really came out after my second pregnancy when I was like, why did nobody help me? How come I had to go through this? Why didn't you do something? Why didn't you believe me? Like, I had tons and tons and tons of anger. And then, because I bonded with my second child and we had a really positive, I should say, still have, because part of my like postpartum mom guilt is that I am now an extended breastfeeder. My kid's going to be 3 in August and she's still on the boob. Because I didn't get that chance with my first kid and I just had so much guilt. And now I'm afraid of like my hormones like dipping if I stop nursing. Mm-hmm. So she's still nursing. She's 3. Getting to be a little intense because she's very upfront when she wants the boob. So I felt super guilty. So I would like put my older daughter, who was almost two and a half at this point, you know, down for bed and spend time with her, and she'd fall asleep and I would like lie next to the floor on her in her room and cry about how sorry I was.
That she had to go through it and the second one doesn't.
Right. Like, I had unbelievable guilt.
Oh, I believe it. I had it.
Yeah. Like, I was just like, and my therapist was super helpful. I'd go and I would just be like, I can't, like, I don't remember these things with her. I didn't know all these things. Like, I couldn't do all these things. But leaving my job, and I was off work for almost 6 months, which was fantastic, before I went back to work part-time. That was a huge part of my healing because I got to spend time with both kids and really bond with them and also, like, rest and eat and heal and go to therapy and also just, like, rebuild my emotional stores, which were really, 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 really depleted from 4 years of working in a super intense environment with violent kids, which I actually really liked. It's just not a good match for a new mom. So I know that sounds weird. Like, oh, you liked having, like, hard objects thrown at your head. You know, like, it takes a certain person, and I am that person. Like, the intensity of emotion, like, the same part of me that's super anxious also is the same part of me that needs that kind of adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
So I got through that. I did not, except for the intrusive thoughts, I did not relapse with panic attacks or anxiety or depression until my second daughter was 2. And at that point, I don't think it was PPD. I should say it didn't feel like PPD, which is why I get really frustrated when there's actually no real medical delineation for postpartum depression. I don't know if people know that.
No, it's a whole mess, I think, the literature.
The literature is a mess, and because I'm a mental health counselor and I diagnose people, one of the things I was thinking about in preparation for this interview is that if any one of us goes and gets treatment, you will be diagnosed with major depressive disorder, and if it's mild, moderate, or severe, or generalized anxiety disorder with panic or panic disorder or OCD. The only one of those that even has a label that says with peripartum onset is depression, and your insurance company actually doesn't get that. There's no paper trail. When your therapist bills for your treatment, there is nothing your insurance company gets that says you have postpartum depression.
I had no idea.
Yeah, people don't know this.
So it's just depression.
Yep.
Thank you so much for sharing. This You're is welcome. So helpful for other moms to hear.
I hope so.
And I think we have a long way to go.
We do.
But we've come a ways.
We have come a long way. You know, and now, 5 years out, I have opened my own therapy office, and I'm actually working with moms with postpartum and perinatal. Actually, I've had more pregnant moms than postpartum moms, which is really interesting.
And I had no idea that perinatal depression was even a thing until after I had postpartum depression and after I started reading about it.
Yeah, I didn't either. I had no idea.
Can None. We get your info about your practice to put on the show notes later?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send you my whole profile.
Anyone listening in Massachusetts who needs to find someone?
Yeah, you can come find me. And it's just been really, it feels really helpful to give. It's helpful to my recovery, even though I don't share most of the time that I'm also a warrior mom with my clients. It's been a good part of my kind of recovery to feel like I'm helping other people. And I've gotten to a point where I've done enough of my own work where I don't like cry or get triggered. When I work with moms whose stories hit some of the same notes as mine. And I waited until I got to that point before I did this work.
And so your patients don't even realize that you're helping them, but they're also helping you.
Yes, they don't know.
And you use, do you want to talk quickly about expressive arts therapy? Or do you got to get back to your girls?
No, my girls are upstairs with their dad. And one of the things that we do is we are one of those parents that split childcare with kind of split shifts. Mm-hmm. So Sunday is the only day that my husband is home all day and I'm home all day. So I'll get back to them in a minute. But we've been having very intense family time since 7:30 this morning.
Oh, okay.
Good. So I'm an expressive arts therapist, which means that I have the same kind of training as any counselor, mental health counselor you see will get in terms of like psychology and diagnosis and working in different, you know, types of treatment facilities. I have specialized training using different arts modalities in therapy. So when people come to therapy with me, we write, we draw, we journal, we use collage, we use music. I have drums in my office. I do a lot of mindfulness and meditation type stuff in different sorts of ways, so it's more accessible for people. And it's really, really fun. And postpartum moms have found it, and perinatal moms have found it really, really helpful, to actually draw pictures of their feelings as opposed to just talking about them. We've noticed it's been really, and it's also fun. I think it's more fun than sitting and talking about your feelings for 45 minutes, which is why I do it.
Well, I had occupational therapy when I spent 4 nights at the hospital, and that was like the thing that connected with me the most, was just sitting down and doing like some arts and crafts and coloring. It was a huge part of my recovery.
Yeah. And I give people prompts like to draw your intrusive thought. What do you actually see? Or another one I do is like I have people draw a womb, WOMB, mm-hmm. with a view.
A womb with a view.
And that helps people because we do it in a bunch of different ways. Like, what do you think they're seeing? What do you want the baby to see? What are you seeing the baby seeing? You know, and that kind of helps them figure out different ways to cope with depressive feelings or anxious feelings.
You gotta write a book about all this stuff.
Maybe I will.
You've got the title, A Womb with a View.
Womb with a View. It's actually an exercise from a book called Birthing from Within.
Uh-huh.
So I took it and made it much bigger.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This podcast is so exciting, and someone, I'm so glad you're doing this because nobody else is.
You know what? There is someone else who's doing it. Dr. Kat. I'm going to share that later on the podcast. There is literally the same week as me, she started That's recording. Exciting. It was like very fun karma out there. And she lives, I'm in Pasadena, she's in Claremont. So like less than an hour away from me.
That's so cool.
Yes. The universe has a sense of humor sometimes.
I agree. It definitely does.
All right. Well, have a good day, Kat. No, thanks. I just called you Kat. That's Dr. Okay. Kat. You're Alexia.
I am. Thank you so much, Courtney. This is really great.
Yes. And I will see you in October.
Yeah, I know. I'm sick. So go Atlanta.
We are Warrior Moms going to the Warrior Mom Conference.
Oh, yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this week. Thank you, Alexia, for sharing your story and your time with me and with everyone listening. And thank you so much for being my guinea pig and being my first interviewee. You were brave to do that. If you have any questions or you would like to be a guest on the show and share your story, please email me at courtney@ppdadventures.com. Postpartum depression and other maternal mental illnesses can feel incredibly lonely, but remember, you are not alone.